Well, good afternoon. Seems like I haven't been here very much. We travel a lot in the summer. We're out of town. It's nice to be here. My daughter and son-in-law went away for an anniversary trip, which means that we are babysitting, which basically means that Shelby is babysitting. And she's got this, as some of you have seen her limping around, she's got some kind of a problem with her hip that a chiropractor is working on. X-rays didn't show anything in there except maybe just a little bit of arthritis, but she's out of whack and had trouble walking. And anyway, we thought, considering she's trying to take care of him and having trouble herself, that it'd be best for her to stay home, but she says hi. And I guess that's all. Keep up to date. I'm going to, this is one of those sermons that didn't end up the way it started. I'll explain that in a little bit. A little over 100 years ago, there was a book written by somebody named Baum. I think he went by L. Frank Baum. It was about a brave young orphan girl who was being raised by her aunt and uncle in a fairly bleak area of the central part of the United States. And a cyclone came by their house and picked the house up and deposited it somewhere in a very different kind of a land. And in this land, one of the first people she runs into is a good witch. This good witch had silver shoes that she gave her, and these silver shoes were supposed to have some magical properties. And this brave girl, during the course of her journey, which she had to see this wizard in order to get back home, and she found a scarecrow, and she released the scarecrow from where he was stuck, and she also rescued a tin woodsman, and also encouraged them and this lion to journey with her to this special city called Emerald City. And of course, you know the story. They wanted to get a brain and a heart and so forth, and they had all these obstacles to overcome. And when they got there to the city, they were asked to wear green glasses, green spectacles, because the person that let them into the city said, you have to wear these special glasses the whole time you're there. Now, you think I'm making all this up, don't you? At least some of it, because it doesn't match with what you know. But this is really what's in the book. When they got there, they had to wear these green glasses the whole time they were in Emerald City. And of course, they were sent out and they had to kill the Wicked Witch. And there were wolves sent to attack them, and crows sent to attack them, and winky soldiers were sent to attack them. And they were all fought out. And there was this golden cap that she had, this golden cap that gave her certain power over the winged monkeys. They looked at whoever had the golden cap. And during the process of trying to go and kill the Wicked Witch, they have more things that they run into. They run into these people, as I mentioned, called the Winkies, these things called the Winkies. And the Winkies like the Tin Woodsman because he rescues them, and they ask him to be their king. And he agrees. As soon as he helps Dorothy get back to Kansas, he will come back and be their king. Well, the wizard, they get back to see the wizard. The wizard gives them these, you know, little things, trinkets, different trinkets than you see in the movie, but gives them trinkets. And the wizard appoints a scarecrow, by virtue of his brains, to be the ruler, because the wizard wants to leave Emerald City and go back to Kansas. Well, then Dorothy goes to the winged monkeys, and they're supposed to take her home. But that doesn't quite work out. They have to fight these fighting trees and these armless hammerheads. I'm not really sure what that means. And the cowardly lion kills a giant spider and rescues all these animals in this forest from this giant spider. And they want him to come and be their king, which he agrees to do after he helps Dorothy get home. Well, they finally get to the palace, Glinda's palace, and she says, you know, Dorothy says she wants to go home, and of course the silver shoes, they said, well, you could get home anytime you want because you have these silver shoes. And she just realizes she can go home, and everybody's going to get to go home. The wing monkeys are going to make sure that the Tin Man gets to where he needs to go, and the Lion will get to where he needs to go, and that the Scarecrow will get back to where he needs to go. She knocks her heels together, and she's able to get back home. And this is the story according to the book. Now, those of you that are familiar with the story, which I hope is pretty much everybody in here, you can probably, if I was clear enough and you were paying attention, you probably spotted some differences. Did anybody catch any difference between what I said and what is in the 1939 movie? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. You gotta speak loud. In the movie, she had ruby-colored shoes, slippers. And, of course, this was one of the first, if not the first, movie that had Technicolor, so silver shoes wouldn't have shown up. You know, they were trying to take advantage of this new technology, Technicolor movies, and they made them red instead of silver. Anything else that you noticed?
They didn't have green glasses in the town was green, but
they didn't have to wear green glasses in the movie, no. There are a bunch of other ones. You remember in the movie, the wizard makes all three of the characters, not Dorothy, but the other three, he makes them rulers of Emerald City, right? Together as a team. In the book, they each have different kingdoms they're going to go to. I didn't make this clear in how I was explaining it, but in the movie, it's all a what?
Dream.
In the book, it's not. The book, it's not. In fact, he intended to write other books, I don't know that he ever did, in which they would make trips to Oz. You know, this was going to be an ongoing thing. It was a real place. The tornado was real. In the book, there's no mention of any farmhands that become characters, or a barker or whatever, the guy that's selling, you know, becomes a wizard. Those characters do not exist in the book until they meet them in Oz, because they're real people. Or real things, I guess. Whereas for her, it's a dream and based on some people she really knows. There's supposed to be, if anybody bothers to count, I guess some people do, there's supposed to be about 44 differences. I don't know what all the differences are. There were no armless hammerheads in the movie. That's why I say I don't even know what they are. I never read the book. I just did a little reading about the book. I've never sat down and read it. There was no spider attacking animals. There was no Joker in the movie. All these things are parts of the book. Has anybody ever watched a movie where they had also read the book? Does the movie follow the book usually? No. Sometimes. It depends. Why is that? Why do people... There could be all kinds of reasons, I guess. Why is it when you make a movie you don't follow the book?
Time.
There were certain scenes in Baum's book, like the hammerheads, and so there was a place he had to walk through China. I assume that means like plates and stuff like that. And those scenes were cut out. It's just, you know, the movie's long enough as it is. So that's one reason you can change time. Maybe because there's not enough time if you did a book. You know, you can make it more or less, whichever, one way or the other. Any other reasons could be? So what? The audience can change. Yeah, I mean, you got to market. When you make a movie, you want people to come to it. So you got to figure out what's going to make people come to it. It may not be everything about the movie or the book may not be attractive to the audience. There could be all kinds of reasons like that, and could be just sometimes they change it just to get a different rating. Yes.
Money.
Well, it's a big reason to change anything. Right. Absolutely. You could change it. Could be any number of reasons. It doesn't matter necessarily what the reasons are, but the point is, you and I read To Kill a Mockingbird and I saw the movie To Kill a Mockingbird. That's probably the only book I've ever read that I saw the movie. Maybe. Ten Commandments. I read the book of Exodus and I saw that. So, maybe a couple times. But we've all seen movies where we read the book, and more often than not, we notice that there are differences between the two. And why is that? Well, because a movie is not usually exactly the book. It's an interpretation of the book. It's a director's interpretation or a screenwriter's interpretation of how can we take this book that they have and put it up on the screen and make it interesting. So what you're seeing is an interpretation. You're not seeing the original. And you all have, you know, any movies that you want to bring up? Anybody have one that they can think of that really, oh, the movie was nothing like the book? Anybody know? I'm not a movie buff, so I don't. I'm sure you've seen one. Pride and Prejudice. Okay, well, I've never read the book. Those of you that like, what are that, Jane Austen or whoever it is? If you like those books, the movie didn't follow the book closely, or?
The American version
The American version, yeah. Well, okay.
I'm just going to say, a book leads much to your imagination, and it's written that way. So, and where when you read a visual, you can't, there's no imagination, so they have to present what you need to see.
That's an excellent point. And that's, boy, I didn't think of that to put in the sermon. Remember it later. Bring it up later. A book leaves, we say something to the imagination. That could be in the sense of a fiction book. Not all movies are based on fiction. Sometimes it's nonfiction. But any book, you can't put every single detail in a book. So a book, and you can't in a movie either, but a book is going to leave some things for your mind to work out, right? Thank you for that point. A book, just because you can't, you'd spend all your life writing every detail if you tried to write a book that took into account everything. Everything that your eyes can see and ears can hear and all that. You can't write it all down. So a book is going to leave some things out that your brain is going to have to either supply, try to figure out, try to imply from the other things that it does know. That's one of the things that makes books interesting. And in the case of a fiction book, in particular, it's why it's good for children. One of the reasons it's good for children to read is that it exercises their imagination to be able to fill in the blanks as to what's going on. That's an excellent point. And if I don't remember to get back to it, somebody remind me. Now I want to expand the concept a little bit and use this as a springboard maybe, a bit of an analogy you might say, that I'm going to make the concept bigger than just movies. And let's consider the phenomenon of the difference between a popular version or a famous version of an event or a saying, or a person, or something like that, and what really happened. You understand what I mean? What I'm after here? Sometimes things get passed down to generation to generation, and we got this story about something, you know, that never really happened that way, because it's gotten twisted over time. And we have this popular version of a history that, well, didn't quite happen that way. Or, perhaps, there's a saying. Someone was, said something, and by the time it goes a few hundred years, gets down to us, or maybe just a year or a few months or something, it gets to us, and it's everybody thinks that person said something different. You got the idea here? I know it's been talked about because I know Hugh has mentioned it in sermons, I think, or I know he's done it personally. I think he mentioned it in a sermon one time. To give an example, the Constitution of the United States. I don't know what percentage. You probably talk to 8 out of 10 people will tell you that the Constitution of the United States says you can open it up and it says there's a separation of church and state. Most people believe that, right? That the Constitution guarantees separation of church and state in the United States. That's absolutely not true. It doesn't say that. Never has. Doesn't say it. But people will pound on their lectern and say, separation of church and state. I think I told you this before. One time I was trying to rent a school to have church in back in Maryland, and the school board, you know, it was a person on the school board and was being, you know, kind of puffed up the chest and whatever. We believe in the, you know, separation of church and state. Can't do that. I said, it's not about that. We just want to pay you money to use the room. You're not showing us any favor. You're not establishing a religion. You're not preferring our religion over somebody else's. You're just taking our money so we can use the room. No. They had a wrong idea about our Constitution. Well, that's just one example of revisionist history. And there are plenty of other ones. Anybody think of any off the top of your head? I'll try to remind you. When I was in high school, this is a literary thing, had to read Hamlet. And what did Hamlet say about this? He picks up I don't know if Hamlet said it. It was might have been somebody else. But he picked up a skull of somebody named Yorick. And says, "Alas, poor Yorick." I think Hamlet did say, "Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him well." It's not in there. It's not in there. That's what we think. It says what Shakespeare wrote was, you have Hamlet, and then you have this guy named Horatio. I think it was Hamlet that picked up the skull. You have a guy named Horatio there, and Yorick was a jester, I think, or something. Or literary people. I don't know where our literary people are today. But I think he was a jester. But Hamlet picks up the skull, and he says, "Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio." He didn't say, "I knew him well." He said, "I knew him, Horatio." He's talking to Horatio. Now, that's insignificant. Who cares? But it's just an example of how things get passed down, and we get it wrong. Because we believe the movie, or we believe perhaps the popular version, and not the real version. Anybody ever seen Casablanca? Humphrey Bogart tells the piano player, what's he telling?
Play it again, Sam.
How many people think he said play it again, Sam? Now you know, you're not going to raise your hand. What did he really say?
Play it.
Play it. Play it. He didn't say play it again, Sam. I don't know where that came from. I don't know why. Why? I don't know why we say that. He said, play it. There's this idea in Dante's Inferno, right? There's a sign. Around the River Styx somewhere? There's a sign before you enter. It says, abandon all hope, right? Ye who enter here. That's what everybody says. It doesn't say that. The word here isn't there. Abandon all hope, ye who enter. Just another one of those examples. Where's our Star Trek fans? Happy 46th. That was yesterday, right? You know what I'm talking? It's their 46th anniversary or something. What's the expression the Kirk's supposed to have said? Obviously, now I'm saying, given the subject, you can figure he doesn't say it, right? What does he say when he wants to be transported somewhere?
Beam me up, Scotty.
Did James Kirk ever say, beam me up, Scotty? No. Never. Not in however many seasons it was on. Never said, beam me up, Scotty. Closest he got, one time he said something like, beam us up, Mr. Scott, or something like that. Usually it was just, you know, it was a bunch of them, not just one, but he never said, beam me up, Scotty. Just one of those examples. I'm just picking at things here, but the point here is to say, well, we get this idea of what something is like or what it says, and it might be distorted a little bit, and we believe the movie, or we believe the popular version, rather than what really happened. What did that queen, I never saw this thing, what did the queen say in Snow White when she's looking at herself? Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the fairest one of all? Well, obviously, I wouldn't have brought it up if we didn't all get that wrong. Magic mirror on the wall. Who's the fairest one of all? But we all say, I don't know how it happens, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest one of all? She didn't say that. But where did that come from? I don't know. Just that's what happens with people. We just mess up. And as you can guess, Sherlock Holmes never said, it's elementary, my dear Watson. Never said that. It was put in movies. Now, in movies it's in there. Never was it in the Doyle books. Never there. I didn't do the research. I'm trusting somebody else. I've heard this one before. George Bernard Shaw said that England and America are two countries divided by a common language. Now, he didn't say that, but he's supposed to have said that. He said something similar, but not real close to that. Now, I might have mentioned this to some of you. I go to these old, Shelby and I go to these old movies during the summer in Gettysburg. And One, I didn't enjoy at all, actually. I couldn't stand it, never saw it before. But, you know, I went, and it was the original Tarzan movie, the first one. Tarzan, the Ape Man, or whatever. And he doesn't talk too much. Johnny Weissmuller. They got him swimming a lot. So, the explorer, or the scientist's daughter, shows up, right? And she's up in the tree with him, and she's starting to try to explain to him who she is. You know, she's Jane. He's Tarzan, right? What's everybody say that Tarzan says? Me, Tarzan, you, Jane. He didn't say that. He never said that. He didn't say me. He didn't use the word me. She's pointing to him, saying, Tarzan. Or I don't know. He didn't have a name. She didn't know his name, I don't think. She says, me, Jane. She's pointing to herself, says, Jane. You know, and then he gets the idea. He says Tarzan. He points to her and says Jane. But he doesn't say me, Tarzan, you, Jane. Here's a good one. What's James Cagney known? What's that expression he's known for? You dirty rat. He never said that. And he claims he never said it. It was some Academy Award or something. He's a guy. I don't know where that, he says. I don't know where that came from. I never said that. Which reminds me of a quote from Yogi Berra. Are you familiar with Yogi Berra and all the goofy things he says? There's pages and pages of his quotes, and they're hilarious. Like 80% of the game's half mental, and that kind of stuff. But he's really defensive about all those kind of things that are attributed to him. And this is one of the greatest quotes of his, and this is a real one. He said, you know, most of the things I said, I didn't say. That's a real quote. How about this book here? Any misquotes you can think of? Where people say it says something and doesn't say it? There's some famous ones. Oh, three wise men. I didn't have that one down. That's a good one. Three wise men. Doesn't say how many. So it's believing the movie, if I can expand the meaning of the word movie into just popular culture. It's believing the movie instead of believing the book. Anything else from the book, from the Bible that comes to mind? Oh, the apple. Apple in the garden. Eve ate the apple. Anything else? There's a lot of things that we would say that, but I mean, how about some famous ones? Or quotes. God helps them who help themselves. It's not in there. Cleanliness is next to godliness. That's not in there. Money is the root of all evil. That's not in there. You know all these things, right? We sang one. A groundhog. We sang one, was one of the last song, not the middle song, but the last song in the first three, I think. We sang one. It's not in there. Now, in principle today, the lion and the lamb. Not in there, is it? Doesn't make it necessarily wrong. It probably will, you know, the principle's okay, but it doesn't say anything about a lion and a lamb. Spare the rod, spoil the child. There's one. Not in there. Jonah and the whale. Doesn't say anything about a whale. This too shall pass. Somebody famous that got up, I forget who it was now. This is when Mike Ditka, I don't know if he was fired from being coach of the Bears or quit or resigned, whatever. He was real sad. He says, you know, like the Bible says, this too shall pass. I'm sorry it doesn't say that. In principle, it says things like that, but that's not a quote. So what's the point of what I'm saying so far? And the point is, if you want to know the way things really are, you have to go to the source. You have to go to the original. You can't always trust what's being said about something. If you want to know if it's accurate, if the movie represents the book accurately, you got to read the book. That doesn't make the movie bad necessarily. I love the movie Gone with the Wind. I've never read the book. I'm just more than happy to have the book match the movie, but it doesn't. But I love the movie. This applies in all areas of life. Those of us that were privileged in our younger days to go through a speech club, had a number five speech. What was that number five speech called? Anybody remember? Get the facts. That was the get the facts speech. You know, that's important, to get the facts, to get the, you know, get what's going on. Proverbs 25:2, don't turn there necessarily. It says, this is the glory of kings to search out a matter. Well, actually, I do want to turn there because it says something else. Proverbs 25 and verse 2. I got the King James up here today. And especially with the Proverbs, sometimes you go to a different version, it says something significantly different. I don't know what yours will say. It says, it's the glory of God to conceal a thing. The New American Standard is similar here. The glory of God to conceal a thing, but it's the honor of a king to search out a matter. So that gives you two things, two principles here, and both of which are going to tie in with what I'm talking about today. One is that it's a good thing. It's the glory of a king. It's an honorable thing for human beings to search out a matter. That could mean looking into the facts before you make a judgment. The Bible's full of that kind of advice. It could mean just our natural desire to figure things out, to explain things. It's something that's kind of naturally in human beings, isn't it? To want to know why. Maybe you're not that way, but a lot of people are. I'm that way. It's part of my nature anyway. I always want to know why. That's why I like physics. You got all these physicists that somehow or another convince the world's governments to spend billions of dollars building accelerators so we can find a Higgs boson. Who cares about a Higgs boson? Well, physicists do. And the interesting thing about the Higgs boson, they haven't found it yet, but there's a group of scientists that are doing these experiments over there in Europe that think they found something that matches some of the qualities that the Higgs boson is supposed to have. Higgs boson would be the elementary particle that gives matter a mass, a weight. That's important for the unified field theory. And if they find that, it'll make everything look all kind of nice and neat in their formulas, the physicists' formulas. But you know what's interesting about that? When I read quotes or hear quotes from some of the physicists, they almost hope they don't find a Higgs boson. Or that if they find it, they find something that's significantly different than what they expect. Because deep down, they kind of don't want all the answers. They want to still be looking for something. There's this desire to find out more. And if this thing just fits exactly what they predicted, you know, look, can we all go home? We don't have a job anymore. I don't know what they're thinking, but they want to be surprised and find out something exciting and a different way to look into something, to search it out. And that's the way God made us. God made us with a desire to search out, especially for relationships. He made human beings with a desire for relationships. So what am I driving at? What's the point of talking about all this? Well, this book right here, the Bible, has a 2,000-year history of being misquoted, quoted, characterized, analyzed, dissected, represented, misrepresented, and otherwise interpreted. Each of us has watched or even been a part of one or more movies, you might say, depictions of what this Bible is about, what it says, what it means. These movies include churches we've been a part of, communities we live in, families we live in, things that we've read, the popular culture we live in, and any other means of representing the Word of God. And I'm preaching to the choir here when I say sometimes the movie doesn't match the book. If you read the book, you find out it's different than what people say. That's not a surprise. But therein lies the danger. Every time you retell the story in a way, there's the risk of being inaccurate, including right now, me up here talking and you sitting there listening. There's a risk that I am going to be inaccurate, right? I'm going to misinterpret. You need to be aware of that all the time. You need to compare, you know, be like the Bereans, search the scriptures, see whether those things are so. There's always a danger of misrepresenting the Word of God. The only way that you can be sure, the only way that I can be sure that our views on the Bible are correct is if we read the book. When this congregation first began, I don't know how many years ago that's been now, lost track, 7 maybe or whatever, 8. There was a series, we had a series. Rick Coop gave there was a video and some book, a book involved called Read the Book, and it was about how to read the Bible, how to study the Bible. And it was a good series, and if you still if you have those things, go, you know, go back and look at the books. They're good. I'm talking not specifically about studying the Bible, but today, if there's one point I want to make, and I'll make it now and I'll make it again, is the point is to read the book. Literally read it. Like, start reading at the beginning, read all the way to the end. You get to the end, start again. Read the book. Because it's a narrative, it's a story that's long, and it covers a lot of ground. And I can turn to this page and I can read this, I can turn to this page and read this, and I can turn back here and read this. But what I'm encouraging you to do is to read through the whole thing. Again and again. And that is the best way to get an overview. And some things that don't seem to make sense when you look at it here and then you look at it here make more sense when you read the whole thing. And you say, oh, okay, that goes with this back here in a way that it helps go together for me. While we're in Proverbs says, you know, it's the glory of God to conceal matter. Now, I don't know exactly. I'm not going to stand up here and say exactly what that means because I don't know. Just that God doesn't always reveal everything. He doesn't spell it all out all the time. Sometimes we need to see a larger picture because the point isn't always obvious. And this gets back to what you were saying about a book leaves certain things to the mind to figure out. And this book is no different. It doesn't mean that you're going to put your own spin on it. You try not to do that, but everything's not always spelled out exactly. And sometimes, if we can turn one page, if you're at Proverbs 25, turn to Proverbs 26. Sometimes you got to use your brain. And it's obvious that you have to. My point here is that you always have to use your brain. Sometimes it's not so obvious. But look at Proverbs chapter 26 and verse 4. This is famous pair of scriptures here. Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you also be like him. Next verse. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit. How do you reconcile those? They obviously contradict with one another. How do you reconcile them? Okay, thank you. I mean, that's a good way of looking at it.
I saw that wasn't original. I read that in contradiction to the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the primary ones that I pick up.
Yeah,
because obviously the writer put them together for a reason, not to be contradicted.
Right. The problem, I guess one of the problems is that there are things similar to this that aren't right next to each other, so it's so obvious. And when we run into those kinds of things, that's where you have to engage the brain a little bit. It's like, what's God saying here in the whole story? This is obvious. This is one writer doing this, or one editor, or whatever. It's one person that decided to stick these together to make a point, or make several points. But sometimes it's something way back here, and something way up here, and it's not just one editor or one writer or something that did that. It's God that's doing that overall. They're sticking this over here and this over here, and they both are—they run at your head from different directions, and they don't seem to add up. So you got to engage your brain a little bit, and that's okay because that's what pretty much all writings do. They require your brain to be engaged. The danger is making sure it's engaged in a godly way. And that's why I'm encouraging you to read the book all the way through. It's been helpful. I notice things that way that I haven't noticed another way. You can be on a schedule. You can be, you know, get busy and not be able to keep it up. Just pick it back up wherever you were. Keep going. Keep going. Read through. Gives you a bigger picture. But this is a classic example here in Proverbs of two verses that require some bit of interpretation in order to apply them. Because they seem, at just on the face of it, to say something that say things that are the opposite of one another. And they are the opposite of one another. The point is, one applies at one particular time, one applies at another time. They don't both apply at the same time. And the Bible's got plenty of that in it. There's a time and a place for everything. That's why I have to read the whole book and not just grab something out of here and say, this applies at all times. I mean, there may be some things we grab at, you know, the commandments or whatever. There are certain things that do apply at all times. Others don't. If it was that obvious, well, I want to back up. Part of the issue has to do with who we are, or maybe more so who I am. I love, as my training in math and science, it's not that what made me what I am, it's I liked math and science because of the way I was already made. And that is, I want to put everything in a box. One and one is two, and it's always two. It's two tomorrow, it was two yesterday, and guess what? It's going to be two next week. That gives me some comfort and security. And that's why Einstein was so troubled when quantum mechanics came along. I'm not going to explain quantum mechanics, but just let me say it in a very layman's point of view. You know, this particle could be here, certain probability it's here, certain probability it's here, we can't say for sure. It could be at both places. And Einstein said, God doesn't play dice. That didn't make sense to him. He didn't like it. Because of the natural desire to stick things in boxes. And he was way out there. I mean, his brain could think beyond most people's, but he didn't like that. It was very new at the time, and I think he came around to see, but at first he didn't like it. I don't like it. I had to study it in college, and I did enough to get a C in the course, and I didn't really understand it, and I didn't like it. But we as Westerners in the Greek tradition, okay, when I say Western, I'm talking about European and further west. We like to categorize things. We like to give, you know, it's one of the great accomplishments of modern science. You take animals and we've got a kingdom and family and phylum, all these things. We can categorize all the animals on earth and put them in their neat little boxes. That's just our nature. It's what we like to do. I suspect, I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect that back in ancient India and ancient China, they didn't really care. Because that's not the way they think. It's just in general, their philosophy, Eastern philosophy, is different than Western philosophy. There's not quite the need to put everything in a box the same way. So part of our struggling with the Scripture, if we struggle, is our desire to have everything in a nice, neat little package and be able to say, you know what, God says this. He says, boom, 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 A, B, C, and it's real simple. Well, I'm here to tell you that sometimes it's not that simple. And there's a good reason for it. Because God, I think, wants us to think. The writers of the Bible, they wrote history, they wrote prophecy, they wrote stories about what happened, you know, narrative, they wrote poetry. They wrote all kinds of things. They weren't worried about writing a systematic theology book that spells it all out for us in very Western terms, like a science textbook. And says, here's your phylum, here's your kingdom, here's your, I don't know the order, your biology people. Phylum, kingdom, class, species, whatever, you know, gets down to species. God's truth is simple in a way, but it's not simple that way. I think it resists being put in a box. Now, why am I even thinking about this? Well, it goes back, it's for two reasons. One is a conversation I had, or probably was several conversations, the last time I was in Thailand with a young man who's there, who enjoyed talking. We had some great conversations. But one of the things he says, you know, he says, there's sometimes a tension in Scripture. He used the word tension. I think it's a good word. There's a tension right here in Proverbs 26, verse 4 and 5. It says this, says this. You put them next to each other, they don't blend. You got to think about it. That's a tension. You put something in tension with, and then it requires your brain to say, all right, and how do I deal with this tension? And I'm here to tell you, I think that's a good thing. That's based on, you know, 40 some years of dealing with it as a human being. I didn't feel that way when I was a lot younger. I felt like I needed to understand everything just perfectly and stick in the box. And that this box is over here, it's always over here. And this box is over here, it's always over here. And guess what? After a lot of years of trying to do that, I'm giving up trying to do that because it resists that. Sometimes God leaves a tension in His Word, I think, for the purpose of having us think about it and wrestle with it a little bit. The other reason, the main reason that I started thinking about the sermon and the sermon did not turn out to be what I started to make it, was a question from one of you about suffering and why. What's God, you know, what's He thinking? When, you know, to use the popular quote, when you or the book title, when bad things happen to good people. What's going on with that? Well, guess what? I can't give you that answer. If you're expecting that answer in a little box, I don't have it. But I'm going to talk about it anyway. Because I think talking about it and dealing with the tension is a good thing. And it leads to some maturity. We just read in James, at the end of chapter 3, that the wisdom that's from above, I didn't have this in my notes originally, the wisdom that's above is first pure and peaceable, with King James, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Well, guess what? Not too many of those things applied to me 30 years ago in the church. I'm hoping some of them apply to me now. But there wasn't a maturity and a wisdom in me as a young person in the church. Why? Well, I guess it wasn't my time and I wasn't ready. But there were a lot of reasons, I think. One reason is because my brain said everything. I got all the answers. In this box is this answer. In this box is this answer. I got most of the answers. That's what I was trained to do. The older I get, the more I realize how foolish I was. That it takes time. And it takes wrestling with the book and wrestling with my life to get to the point where I can be peaceable, gentle, pure, easy to be entreated. I hope I'm that way a little bit now, but you talk to anybody that knew me 30, 40 years ago and they wouldn't say I was that way. Or full of mercy. That takes time. Some of you are very good at that. Some of you are good at that because you've lived it and learned it, like I have. I'm not saying I'm good at it, but I'm better at it than I was. That's my point. Hopefully I'm moving in the right direction. Part of the reason is because I struggle. I struggle with questions like I got and didn't have an answer to. I struggle because at the feast, I'm going to participate in a group that's going to sing this song on Eagle's Wings. I love this song. From Psalm 91. I love this song. I love our worship team, if you want to call it that. We got trumpet we're so spoiled. We got trumpet, piano, song leader. Really appreciate that. It's hard to give some special music. You who dwell in the shelter of the Lord, who abide in His shadow for life, say to the Lord, my refuge, my rock in whom I trust, and He will raise you up on eagle's wings, hear you on the breath of dawn, make you to shine like the sun, and hold you in the palm of His hand. And there's several more verses like that. When I read that psalm, in my regular Bible reading, I'm in the Psalms. And there's an awful lot in the Psalms. So you could spend your whole life just studying the Psalms. I'm not studying the Psalms right now. I'm just reading them. So I read this one, Psalm 91. Surely He will, I'll start verse 1. He that dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him will I trust. and he will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. That's in one of the other verses of that song. He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you shall trust. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor for destruction that wastes at noonday. 1,000 will fall at your side, and 10,000 at your right hand, and it will not come near you. Only with your eyes shall you behold and see the reward of the wicked. Because you have made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, my habitation, there shall no evil befall you, neither shall any plague come near your dwelling. For he will give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways, and they will bear you up in their hands, lest you dash your foot against a stone. And you will tread upon the lion and the adder, and the young lion and the dragon. You shall trample under feet. Because he has set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high because he has known my name. He shall call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation. That's a wonderful psalm. It's very encouraging. It's pretty much quoted in this song here, pretty much the whole thing. Now, here's my obvious question. Is this an unconditional promise? Nothing bad will ever happen to you because you're one of God's people? You could read it that way. Jesus understood it differently, I think. In Luke chapter 4, see, the devil quoted this to him. The devil quoted, he knows the Bible. He quoted Psalm 91. What we call the temptation. Luke chapter 4, and we'll start in verse 9. It's the third one that's in the way it's mentioned here by Luke. It says, he, that is, the devil, brought him to Jerusalem and sat him on the pinnacle of the temple, Luke 4 and verse 9. Set him up high, you know. The temple's up high on the mountain, plus the temple was high itself. Said to him, if you're the Son of God, cast yourself down from here. For it's written, he shall give his angels charge over you to keep you, and their hands will bear you up, lest at any time you dash your foot against a stone. And Jesus' answer was, well, you don't tempt. You don't tempt God. It's a good answer. The devil, it appears to me, wanted to put God in a box and say, you know, God has to do this because it says so in Psalm 91. And Jesus wasn't biting for whatever reason. And you could read Psalm 91. And I'm not bringing these things up because I'm trying to be negative. You can say, oh, you're just being negative here. I'm trying to be realistic. We're, you know, for the most part, except for our young people here, we're mature Christians who've been around for a long time. The reality is that in the New Testament, John the Baptist, who was in his early 30s, or maybe just turning 30 or so, died for his trouble. Jesus died for his trouble. Stephen died for his trouble. James, Paul, Peter, and the list goes on. You can include heroes of the faith, if you want to call them that or not, or just different ones who have tried to serve God in the last 2,000 years. Years and years ago, Ignatius, who wrote some letters on his way to Rome to be killed. Tyndale, who translated the Bible into the vernacular, into common language, paid for it with his life. I got a book at home. Maybe you've got it. Fox's Book of Martyrs. This whole book full of people who died for their troubles. So, how do you put Psalm 91, on the one hand, together with the reality that we have martyrs? Like, I'm not trying to be negative. I'm trying to be realistic. This is the God that you and I serve and worship. And he wants us to think about these kind of things. And I can get up and sing this song, and I do. I love it. And it has meaning for me. But the meaning for me is not that God guarantees that I won't literally dash my foot against a stone. He has the power to do that. But what would I learn in life if... You know, everybody remember the commercial, Staples commercial, and had a big red button? What was that called?
Easy button.
Easy button. I grew up in an environment, my family in the church and so forth. Not that was it without its trials. We had plenty of trials. But the teaching that I was given, some of it, as a look back, and I'm not pointing a finger at anyone or trying to be critical, I'm just saying this is the way it came down, was almost like, you know, God's called a special people and given every one of them an easy button. When you got a problem, just press it. Because we have all these promises. And God's a God of his word, and he is. But then, all right, they all died before their time. I mean, these, the ones I mentioned before. What if you had a charmed life where every time you know, and say you made a mistake and you were going to have to pay some kind of penalty for it, you could just press the easy button and the penalty of your mistake would go away. And that was your church, you know, because of the church you were in, maybe. That church could get real big real fast, maybe. Easy button church. Well, you're all living proof that it's not that easy. Not that simple. But part of the culture that I was reared in, it's like, well, not enough faith. Maybe the person didn't have enough faith. Or... not obedient. There's all these reasons why God didn't have to do this and that for them. God didn't have to heal them when they were sick because not quite obedient enough. Like somehow you earn that. Well, I don't believe that now. I don't know that I ever believed it a lot, but it was fed to me when I was little. And it was part of my makeup for a while. Again, Psalm 91 is one chapter in a book that has, I don't know how many, hundreds, thousands of chapters? Certainly many thousands of verses. It's one part of a big picture. It pays to get the whole overview, I think. I think it's important. You know, what do we see? If we have this tension, and I believe that's a good word that my friend in Thailand, he's American, but he was there serving. I think that's a good word. Say there's a tension. God leaves a tension. He doesn't spell out every scene in such detail so that when you look at the movie, you don't end up with any questions. Now, you and I can say me, I can't speak for you, but perhaps you, have been involved in certain movements, in certain... belief systems and so forth, where we had a movie that claimed to have all the answers and fill in all the blanks. At least those of us of a certain age have been there. And it was a real crisis for some of us when we found that the answer in this box that was supposed to come into play when we pushed the easy button in this particular situation didn't work. It wasn't really the answer. We had to suffer for a while. You've suffered. I've suffered. Any of us of a certain age. I'm not complaining. I haven't suffered near as much as some of you. And I haven't had to bleed and I haven't had to do a lot of things. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying I've had the experience of not getting an answer that I wanted or not getting any answer for a while, and have to live with that. And what happens? The brain's work. You know, you start thinking, don't you? And you read the Bible. And you pray. And God gives you more understanding. Ah, amazing. And what do we learn through all of this? I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But God does what He wants, doesn't He? You know, I was talking about John the Baptist, for instance. First martyr in the New Testament, I guess. And even he had a moment of doubt. Remember, he sent his disciples in Luke 7. He sent disciples to a couple disciples to Jesus. Said, are you the one that we're looking for, or are we looking for somebody else? We need to wait. And Jesus said, you know, look at the signs and so forth. Here's John the Baptist. And Jesus said, there's no man greater. No man born of woman or something to that effect greater than John the Baptist. But he was doubting. He's in prison. Things didn't go well. I think he was in prison at the time. Do I have that right? He ended up paying with his life anyway. And, you know, the easy button wasn't working for him. And he began to have some doubts. Am I doing all this in vain? Was it a waste? Well, it wasn't. But it's okay to wrestle with those things. There was tension in John's life. And Jesus made, you know, positive comments, sent him back. You know, to encourage him. They were kin, they were related. You know, not only did John, you know, not only did these great men, you read Hebrews 11, the heroes of the faith, you know, they're sawn asunder. They didn't dash their foot against a stone, they got cut in half with a saw. How does that work? Well, it doesn't work with an easy button. It works because God has something bigger in mind. Why this tension? Why? And I, trust me, I'm not up here saying I've got all the answers or that I can even answer this one. I'm just encouraging us to think about it, and I'm going to give you a little bit. Isaiah 55. This is what's been a memory scripture for me since I was very young. A couple of them in the same chapter here. Isaiah 55. And verse 8 and 9. Talking about how God will abundantly pardon those that are wicked when they come to Him. And He says, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Well, I'm not sure which measurement we're talking about here, what part of the heavens. But the moon, with close neighbors, what is it, 260,000 miles worth, Justin? 260,000 miles away? Is that about the moon? It's about 260,000? Something like that. That's pretty high from here. Sun's 93 million. And the heavens are, you know, much further away than that. What's the point? The point is there's absolutely no comparison between the level that God's mind's on and the level that our mind's on. It's not close enough to make a comparison. This is like a hyperbole. It's an exaggeration. This is the best we can do given our limited minds to say the difference between God and man. We just say, as far as the heavens are above the earth. It's the most, I think that for Isaiah, that was the best way he could describe the difference. He tried to pick what something is so very, very different from something else, or so far away from something else. All right, you got the heaven and the earth. That's how different God is from us. That's what's beautiful about this, is that, and this wasn't in my notes, but I was just thinking about it, the whole book, the narrative here that says about what God's doing, and doing it through Jesus, that's the whole process. It's not an easy button, it's a hard button. But the result of that button is that God spans that divide. It does say we're going to see Him as He is. We're going to be like Him. So as high as the heavens are above the earth, God, through Jesus, His Son Jesus, is going to bridge that gap. That's amazing. But it's not easy. There's no easy button. It's a hard button. But it's possible. It's doable. That's the amazing thing. That's what's beautiful about it. And some beautiful verses, that there's some music written in verses 10 and 11. As the rain comes down and the snow from heaven and returns not there, but waters the earth. In other words, snow and rain, they do their job. God sends them and they do their job. They're not just wasted. And he says, his word is that way. So shall my word be in verse 11. Go forth out of my mouth and it will not return to me void, but it will accomplish that which I please and prosper in the thing where I sent it. So God is in the business, you might say, of bridging that gap between where we are and where he is. And what that's a monumental job. It's an impossible job. We can't even imagine. Now how does he do it? Well, I don't have an answer there. I just got a whole book here, and one of the things he does is he lets us suffer. He lets us not get answers immediately. And he lets us wrestle with the word. God says his word doesn't return to him void and empty. It accomplishes something down here. What does it do? It accomplishes something because we wrestle with it. We wrestle with the tension. And it should affect us. We should change with time. I was going to read all of 1 Corinthians 13. I don't think I will. But 1 Corinthians 13, you all know, is the love chapter, right? We call it the love chapter. And it talks about having gifts, gifts of preaching, gifts of knowledge, understanding, all this good, wonderful stuff. And Paul says again and again, I don't care if you have all that stuff. If you don't have true love, it's worthless. You got everything in a box. You got it all organized. You understand this and you understand that and you understand something else and you treat your neighbor wrong. None of that stuff counts for anything. He says it's all about how you treat each other. He says, I don't care if you could move mountains because you have so much faith. How do you treat your neighbor? Of course, this has been in here my whole life, but I'm just now I'm getting older. I'm just now starting to understand it in a way I never had a clue when I was younger. Love is the key. Now, where does that lead? All these verses about love. Verse 9. For we know in part, we prophesy in part. He's saying, we don't really understand it all. We don't have it in all the boxes we think we have it in. But when that which is perfect is come, that which is in part will be done away. When I was a child, I understood things as a child. So he relates it to something we can all understand. We didn't understand certain things when we were kids. We got older, we understood them. And he's saying it's the same way. God is helping us to understand things that we did not understand when we began our walk with him. And the only way we're going to understand is if we grow up. If we get mature, just like our children, how do they learn? I'm having a ball because I get more time with my latest grandson. I don't get to see the other ones. And I'm seeing this last one a lot. And it's just amazing to me. And I've learned a lot about child psychology in the last however many years since I had my own. And it's fun for me to watch his development. And it's not because he's smart or because he's this or because he's that. It's just because there are certain things that a one-year-old and two-week-year-old can do that a one-year-old couldn't do. In other words, I'm just saying, your brain crosses a threshold and you can do something you couldn't do yesterday. That's neat to see that. I just get excited every day. It's something. And I'm thinking, he couldn't do that before. And it's not that he even learned to do it. It's that his brain power expanded just a little bit here in one direction where he could do this thing that it wouldn't even have occurred to him yesterday. That's neat. And Paul compares a Christian life to the same thing. That there's things that you understand now that you didn't have a prayer of understanding 10 years ago. Why? Because your brain wasn't ready. The whole thing, your relationship with God. That gap is so wide. And he's letting us, you know, close that gap just a little tiny bit, but maybe it's a difference of how far away Alpha Centauri is, and maybe we get to the moon. You know, well, Alpha Centauri is still way, way, way far away. But we're moving in that direction. What's he saying in verse 12? For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know even as I am known. He says, it's like looking in a smoky mirror. You know, make something out there. I can't really tell what it is. I know it's something, but I can't see too well. See, if you had the easy button, you could just press it, and then you could see real clear. We don't have that. It's a hard button. And that's the way God made it. It's all about how we love one another, how we care for one another, how we treat one another. That's really, I think that's the bottom line. We could look at a lot of things. We could, you know, I'm talking about, in this case, about Psalm 91 and protection and God's blessing in that way. But, you know, I could turn to scriptures that talk about God prospering us. And, you know, this whole ministry is based on, out there, based on, what do they call it, a health, wealth gospel. You know, that if you just claim it, or what's it, name it, claim it, you know, God's got to give it to you. God's got to reward you. It works for the people in those ministries because everybody sends them money. And they get rich. I don't know how it works for the regular Joes. But, you know, that's we could say that. We could say God promises prosperity, but I'm still poor. Well, again, read Hebrews 11. God didn't give them all prosperity. Some of them were. Abraham was a rich man. He was pretty rich before God ever called him, apparently. Could apply it to healing, could apply it to long life. If you had an easy button every time something went wrong with your body, we could never die. Now, I know that's a pat and a silly answer. You say, well, you could say to me, well, how about when a child is sick? Well, I'm with you on that. I don't know what God has in mind all the time. I just know it's not as simple as I wish it was. But part, you know, how, just for example, there are many. We read inadvertently James 1 today. And it says in there, in James 1, that pure religion and undefiled is to look after the widows, the fatherless, in their affliction. Right? It says that. If God never let anybody be afflicted, how could you practice pure religion? It's my desire, my Western desire to be logical here, right? Pardon me for just a minute here. I want to be logical. You can't care for people who are suffering if God doesn't let anybody suffer. It's just the way it is. But part of our training, part of what God is developing in us, requires us suffering and us helping other people who are suffering. That's just the way it is. I didn't make it that way. But that's the way it is. Do I understand it? No, I don't claim to understand it. I'm just saying that's the way it is. I don't always understand it. I'm gonna change my order here a little bit. John 21. In John 21, this is one of the appearances of Jesus after he had been resurrected. And he's talking to Peter. I'm sure the others are there. He's talking to Peter. And this is the one, you know, do you love me? You know, yes, I love you. That episode. John 21, verse 14, beginning. This is the third time Jesus showed himself to the disciples. And after they ate, you know, he says, Simon, do you love me? And he says, yes, I love you. You know, he said, feed my sheep. All right, they went through that, what, three times, I think. Yeah, verse 17 says, he said to him the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, do you love me? And we could say, all right, it's a different word for love the different times. And that could be the point. My point is not to explain that script, those verses. Peter was grieved because Jesus kept asking him the same question, and Jesus wasn't satisfied with the answer. So that kind of had Peter on the defensive a little bit. Verse 18 says, when you were young, you clothed yourself and walked where you wanted, but when you're old, you shall stretch forth your hands, and another will put your clothes on and carry you where you don't want to go. And by the time the book of John was written, Peter had already been martyred, and tradition says, I believe, that he was crucified upside down or something like that. So he was carried somewhere he didn't want to go. This spake he, signifying by what death he should glorify God. That just in itself is a little bit foreign for us, isn't it? Those of us who would like to have an easy button, and I'm one, thinking that death, you know, a martyrdom somehow glorifies God, that's not a fun thing to think about. Well, Peter, as we do humanly, right? He said, well, what about this guy over here? What about him? All right, so I'm gonna have bad stuff happen to me, but how about him? These people are very human, just like us. Jesus said, if I want him to wait around until I get back, until I come, what's that to you? Follow me. And then the disciples started saying that this disciple would still be living when Jesus returned. You can do with that what you want to. They either had the wrong idea or it was fulfilled perhaps in, you know, the vision of Revelation or whatever. It doesn't really matter. They didn't always understand. So what's the point? Why do I want to read that? Because Peter, trying to be very logical, you know, somewhat, he's not a Greek, but he's trying to figure things out. He said, well, how about him? And Jesus says, you know what? I can do what I want with him. You do what I'm asking you to do. What does that tell you? It tells me that God, Jesus is, and God, speaking for God here, is sovereign. He's in charge. He can do what he wants. And it may not be what we would pick. And his answer to us is just do what I tell you. Follow me. You know, I told you what I want you to do. You feed my sheep. Don't worry about what he's going to do. That's not your job. That's my job to worry about what he's going to do. Your job is to do what I told you. And that, as simple as it sounds, is, I think, that's the answer. That's the bottom line. There's a lot of things we'd like to know the answer to that we can't. But God's sovereign. He tells us what to do. God doesn't always do things the way we would if we were making the plans. In fact, he usually doesn't do it the way we would. Just for an example, in Matthew 10 and in Matthew 24, I won't read Matthew, I'll go to Matthew 10. Just read a couple of verses, but you can turn to Matthew 24, verse 9. Matthew 10, there are several verses here that talk about being brought before kings and governors and testimony, you know, and these people are going to want to kill you. You can say, well, this is specifically talking to the 12 disciples. Maybe so. But it's been true throughout history since then. When he persecutes you in one city, flee to another. Disciples not above his master. In other words, look what they're doing to me, he said. Don't expect it to be any different for yourself. Why does that gel with Psalm 91? Well, it doesn't. Not in an easy way, does it? That's some of that tension. That's some of that brain work you got to do. I'm not saying that one's true and the other's not. That's not the point. The point is, when does this apply and how does it apply? We wrestle with that. And that's okay. It's okay to wrestle with that. Matthew 24, point blank, says in verse 9, they will kill you and many will be, well, deliver you up to be afflicted and kill you. So this is what happened to the disciples. When they had Psalm 91 in their Bible, they didn't expect that it would apply to them in a way that they couldn't be hurt. That, in fact, if you read their stories and some of the extra-biblical things as well, they expected to die in a similar way that Jesus did. They almost felt that that was their lot, that was what they ought to do in a way. So you have here that the prediction that people will in one way or another suffer for their beliefs throughout history. I think it applies throughout history. But you and I have been part of a movie, at least I have, I've been part of a movie, and maybe you have too, that reads Revelation 3 and verse, whatever, 21, 22, 23, somewhere in there, and says, okay, we have different historical eras of the church, and a particular era of the church is not going to have to suffer. They get to go, they get to be protected. Then we go to Revelation 12 and we add that to it and say, all right, these people don't have to suffer at all. They get to go somewhere else. We tie that in with some other scriptures, I think back in Isaiah. And we have a whole system of interpretation which says, in effect, bad things happen to other people, not us. Go for that if you want. It's not something just in the past. I heard a message exactly like that very recently. I'm not hoping that people suffer. I'm just saying that we can, in our wrestling with these things, we can wrestle with them in a way that's maybe not honest with the scriptures. And that's why, again, why I keep coming back to the same point here. And the main point is, read through them all. Don't grab this one from here and this one from here and this one here and build a something here, build a thing of Legos, of blocks, building blocks that comes up like this, and ignoring this and this and this. Read the whole thing. Get a feel for what God is doing in the big picture. We are experts, if nothing else, we're experts at proof texting, taking a little here, a little there, a little this, to make a point that we already believe. I've done that. I give a sermon, I already know what I want to say, I just go looking for the scriptures to say that. What across one that doesn't fit? Can't read that one. All right. No. Hopefully, I don't do that to you anymore. But I mean, there's a time, you know, just without even being conscious about it, we do that. This one doesn't fit my scenario, so I'll leave it out. Or I'll have an explanation for why it doesn't mean what it sure seems to say. I just saw a friend of mine talking about movies. Just saw a friend of mine recently, and he. I've known him. We've been Church of God since we're both kids. And actually, he spent some time outside. Didn't attend. But he kept reading the Bible. And he said, Brian, he said, it says this and this and this and this. He just goes on and on, you know. He says, I was always told what it said. But I'm reading it, and it doesn't say exactly what they said it said. Now he's going back to church, and sometimes he gets all frustrated because he sits and listens to a sermon where they say it says something. He said, it doesn't say that. No, he doesn't get up and shout that, but he gets frustrated. He was about ready to walk out the other week. So I'm praying for him. And the reason is because there's a certain amount of tension there. Because he says, well, it says this, and they say it doesn't mean what it says. Now, sometimes his understanding may be incorrect. There could be reasons why. I'm not saying he's always right and they're always wrong. That's not my point. But my point is he spent some time over and over again just reading the Bible. And every once in a while, or maybe more than every once in a while, he was surprised by something he found. He said, what's in there? Nobody told me. That's why it's important to read it all. So what is important? What's the answer? Well, I already read James 3:17. There's a certain maturity that we get from struggling and wrestling. You know, the story about Jacob wrestling with the angel or Jesus or whatever it was. Wrestling, getting his hip out of joint, limping around like my wife's been limping around because her hip's out of joint. You know? That's a story. Why is it in there? It's in there because you have to wrestle too. You have to wrestle. It's not all fun and games with a break for milk and cookies. That's not the way it is. It's a wrestling match in a way. And one of our spiritual fathers is known for a wrestling match where he didn't give up and he got his name changed. We need to be prevailers with God too. Okay, so how do I sum this up? Micah 6 verse 8, another memory scripture since I've been little. You know, what matters? What matters? Micah 6 8 says, He has showed you, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of you. What does he require of you but to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with God? Do justly and love mercy. In other words, do what's right, just like Jesus told Peter. You know, do what I told you. Love mercy, That works both ways, doesn't it? Appreciate that God is merciful to me, and at the same time, let that flow through and extend mercy to other people. And walk humbly. You know, be humble. Don't have to have all the answers. Don't have to think you have all the answers. And then Jesus, you know, somebody asked him, Matthew 22, you know, what's the important commandment of the law? You know, in other words, sum it up, Jesus. You know, in 15 words or less. Somebody asked me that question one time. Said, in 15 words or less, what's the bottom line? Or what's God want us to do? Or what's the gospel? Maybe it was what's the gospel. I don't know. No, it wasn't what's the gospel. 15 words or less, what does God want us to do? My answer was Matthew 22. Luckily, it came to my brain. I said, love God with all your heart and all your soul and your might, and love your neighbor as yourself. I don't know if that's 15. I counted them while I was saying it. That would be my answer to how in the shortest number of words possible can you say what God wants? Yeah, it's Matthew 22, verse 36. What's the great commandment? Jesus said, love your Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. It's the first and great commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And then verse 40, which is a wonderful little verse. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. What's that mean? Well, let me just throw this out. I can't promise you that this is exactly right, but it sounds to me like Jesus is saying, okay, there's a lot of stuff in here. There's a lot of pages. They didn't have pages, they had scrolls. There's a lot of scrolls there in the temple. But if you remember this, two things. If you remember these things, all the rest of those scrolls wrap around that. Love God with all your being and love your neighbor the way you love yourself. If you got that down, everything else wraps around that. And if I can add, take a little liberty here, it doesn't really matter if you understand all the rest of that, if you got the core of it. If everything's based on this, and you understand this, maybe if you don't understand all the little details about what's wrapped around it, it's okay. Because you've got the core. So again, I encourage you. Get the whole picture. Read the whole book. Let it speak to you verse by verse, book by book, and the entire story, which of course begins in the Old Testament, goes all the way to the New. You know, there's a long narrative, a long story. God is sovereign. God does what He pleases. What is faith? If you had an easy button, there'd be no need or use for faith. Because faith is believing what you can't see. Easy button, boom, happens, fixed. We need to trust God, and we do. I'm not saying that we don't, but we trust God in how He takes care of us and how He takes care of others. That's faith, because it doesn't always fit what we think it ought to be. But we pray. We pray. Pray according to His Word. Say, God, this is what we want. This is what we desire. Sometimes we get our desires. So we've all seen the movies. Hundreds of times, actually. Maybe not all the same exact movie, but we've seen movies. In other words, we've seen versions of what this book says. Or we've been given versions. We've heard versions. You're hearing one today. Do they always match the book? Well, no, they don't. We've read things that are wrong. We believe things that are wrong. That's part of the process of growing. What can you do about that? Read it. Read the book. And you know what you do when you're done? Read it again. And then read it again. Make it a lifelong habit, what bit of life we have left. Read the book. Read the book, live by God's words, and let God speak to you by those words, and wrestle with those words when we need to. All of them, all the way from the beginning to the end.